Do you ever watch the news and think, whoa, this seems...
Unprecedented?
Unprecedented.
It's unprecedented.
This has never happened before. This is unprecedented.
I'm Matt Bevan, and my show, if you're listening, is about finding times that what's happening now has happened before and figuring out what we can learn from it. Learning from history. I mean, who could imagine? New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Ngunnawal country in Canberra and acknowledging other custodians, I'm Katie McAllister, and today on The Breakfast Wrap. Jolene, 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 Jolene. Flags will be flying at half-mast across America today in honour of country music legend Dolly Parton, who's died at the age of 80.
Rest in peace, Aunt Dolly, Aunt Granny, Gigi. May God bless Dolly Parton, and may God bless you all. She will always love you.
We'll be reflecting on Dolly Parton's legacy. Then, the National Cabinet meets today with rules for data centres on the agenda.
Well, federal legislation is absolutely crucial to ensuring that we don't have a race to the bottom.
The federal government wants to require data centre projects to bring their own energy in the form of renewables backed by gas as a firming option. You'll hear opposition to that idea from the Northern Territory's Chief Minister, Leah Fenocchiaro. From Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians, I'm Katie McAllister, and this is The Breakfast Wrap. Katie McAllister in the chair today, and the musical chairs continue on Radio National Breakfast with Luke Sidham-Dundon hosting the radio program for Sally Sara this morning, and our political correspondent Tom Crowley conducting some key political interviews too. Those will be in your ears shortly. But first, she was one of the rare celebrities whose appeal transcended generations, geography and politics. Dolly Parton, country music legend, has died at the age of 80. The country music icon's soaring vibrato vocals, poignant songwriting and sparkling costumes defined her journey from a log cabin in the Tennessee mountains to the heights of stardom and acclaim. With classic songs like Jolene, 9 to 5 and I Will Always Love You, Dolly Parton became one of the best-selling female artists of all time, with more than 100 million records sold. We woke up this morning devastated by the news that the world was a little less rhinestoned, a little less sparkly. And so we hit the phones to find people to speak to, and we landed one of the Rolling Stones writers who penned Dolly Parton's obituary. Jonathan Bernstein's a senior research editor and writer at Rolling Stone, and he spoke to Luke from New York, where flags are being flown at half-mast.
Well, I can only say the mood at Rolling Stone, where I work over the past few hours, has been one of chaos and mourning. I haven't left my desk since the news broke, but I think everybody in the country, I think Dolly Parton, you know, to lose her is to lose a piece of America and a piece of the story America tells about itself. So I think that collectively and nationally and culturally, the country is indeed in a sort of state mourning at the moment.
What did it feel like to write that obituary, to pour back through what has been such an incredible life?
To your point, Dolly lived such a deep life and a rich life and had such an illustrious career up until, you know, this year, up until her death, that, you know, when we write obituaries early at Rolling Stone, which we, of course, do like any news organization, we found ourselves having to continually update it because Dolly, her influence and her culture on just American music and American life, even in the last decade, had continued to find new ways to sort of insert itself into culture. So it was a profound and almost impossible task.
I guess there you're referencing that podcast, Dolly Parton's America, which, you know, really revealed, I guess, another side of the whole story, right?
the podcast. You know, the only time I got to see Dolly perform was at the Newport Folk Festival in 2019, when she sort of performed with a younger generation of artists like Brandi Carlile and the High Women. People just, and that's just one tiny example of the sort of countless and continual intergenerational influence that she had on so many different artists from so many different genres.
Talk to me more about that, because you're right. There's country artists, pop artists, artists in every genre. You've got Miley Cyrus, more recent artists as well. I mean, do you have a sense of the tributes and the impacts that people are talking about today?
Yeah, I mean, to measure her impact sort of musically, it's almost impossible to do. It's, you know, Dolly's music touched on pop music, on bluegrass music, on, of course, country music, on disco. I don't think that you have anyone from Miley Cyrus to Shania Twain to Taylor Swift to Chappell Roan without, you know, if you remove just a few albums from Dolly's career, I'm not sure if those artists have the type of career that they are able to have. And that's just one tiny, tiny little slice of, I think, the impact musically and as a songwriter and vocalist that Dolly's had.
The feelings this morning, I'm sure, are a sense of sadness, but for people listening to you speak right now, there's probably a sense of jealousy. You said you saw her perform once at Newport Folk Festival in 2019. Tell me about that. What was she like on stage? It's not an experience many people get to see.
It was an unbelievable moment, and you know, she was actually, it was a surprise. No one knew that Dolly would be performing, and about a few hours... A few hours before, everybody sort of in the backstage area noticed a ton of sort of like black limousines and men dressed up with, you know, like black suits and stuff. And we're all wondering, what the heck is going on? This isn't your typical special guest sort of setup. And Dolly took the stage with basically an all-woman set and sort of group of artists, all of whom she had influenced, from, you know, Maggie Rogers to Linda Perry to Brandi Carlile to Maren Morris. And she sang about four or five songs. She did a duet with Brandi Carlile on I Will Always Love You that stands today as one of the most unforgettable live music and maybe just life experiences of my life. Hearing her sing that song, I was probably 20 feet away. It was unbelievable.
So a surprise for all of you, but planned, right? She'd planned to be there.
She had definitely planned to be there. She just had, it hadn't been announced. And it was kind of it was a really powerful moment that I think showed the type of torch passing moment that she had had on roots in country music. And it was also a moment for generations of fans and artists to pay tribute to her while she was still alive. And I'm so glad that I got to witness just one of countless moments that, you know, of celebrating Dolly's life while she was still alive in the past decade.
As loud as a lot of the acclaim was for her, and I'm sure, I guess the tears will be today with her passing, a lot of what she did in quite an understated way. You know, she moved around the world helping people, helping other artists, influencing people, getting up on stage unannounced. She really, you know, did so much without making a huge deal about it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think she was very quiet about her worldview in her own way. You know, she was obviously both everywhere and kind of nowhere as a cultural figure, but she sort of just let her actions and her kindness and her empathy, both in her public life and in her music, sort of speak for itself, I think, to your point. And she rarely, if ever, made any sort of loud proclamations or did, you know, she did the opposite of ever trying to force her worldview on anyone else, probably for business purposes as well as personal and moral ones. But yeah, she really went about her celebrity in a deeply graceful way, which is saying something given the nature of her global celebrity.
Jonathan Bernstein, what's the song that you're going to be playing later today to remember her?
For me, it's a little duet. It's a song from the 70s called Do I Ever Cross Your Mind? It's one of hundreds of Dolly songs that she wrote that we don't know as well as the Jolene's and the I Will Always Love You, but it's a testament to her absolute genius as a songwriter.
Jonathan Bernstein's a senior research editor and writer at Rolling Stone. Valet Dolly Parton. Turning now to a big federal political story. State and territory leaders are calling on the Prime Minister to scrap GST funding arrangements which favour Western Australia, despite Anthony Albanese ruling out any changes. The GST debate's reignited after an interim report from the Productivity Commission called the current system a costly mistake, drawing a barrage of criticism from both sides of politics, led by WA Premier Roger Cook. And before we hear from one of the report's authors, let me bring in our political correspondent, Tom Crowley, to explain where this story's at.
No one would more rather that we stop talking about the Productivity Commission than the Productivity Commission. But Alex Robs, the deputy chair, look, Roger Cook's called them clowns. Madeleine King said yesterday that she could understand that sort of language. They've been called economic rationalists by the Prime Minister. Whether that's an insult depends on your point of view. Alex Robson rejecting those comments and defending the PC's credibility, integrity and staff in comments in the Financial Review. Jim Chalmers also making a comment saying the Productivity Commission is a really important institution full of good people. I respect their role and their work. Work, says Jim Chalmers.
Tom Crowley there, more from him shortly. Economist Dr. Angela Jackson is a commissioner at the Productivity Commission, and she co-authored the GST Distribution Reforms Interim Report. And here's her interview this morning on Radio National Breakfast with Luke.
Remind us, what exactly was the Productivity Commission tasked to do in preparing this report?
Yeah, so it's a good question, Luke. We were tasked through the 2018 legislation, which introduced the reforms, to undertake a review of those reforms by the end of this year to look at whether or not they were meeting their intent, whether or not they were working efficiently or effectively. Now, these reforms fundamentally changed the way in which the Commonwealth Government distributes GST revenue to the states and territories, introduced a floor in those arrangements to guarantee that all states would receive at least 0.75 relativity compared to other states, introduced a standard state benchmark so that no state could fall below the share received by the fiscally stronger of New South Wales or Victoria, and also topped up the pool of GST distributed to the states to ensure, or to try to ensure, didn't quite succeed, that no state would be worse off as a result of these reforms. Now, we found that, in fact, the only state that is better off from these reforms has been Western Australia, to the tune of around $23 billion in the first 6 years of operation, and that other states would have, in fact, been worse off had it not been for the No Worse Off guarantee, which is currently costing the Commonwealth Government and Commonwealth Government taxpayers around $6 to $7 billion a year.
So that is why you've described this as such a costly mistake in your report. In the process of writing this report, you did talk to state treasurers, but I wonder if you heard reactions like this, because here's what the WA Premier Roger Cook said about your interim recommendations last month.
It's a sign that these East Coast clowns simply do not understand Western Australia. The changes they have proposed will rip up to $6 billion out of the Western Australian economy.
Dr. Angela Jackson, what do you make of those comments? Were they helpful?
Look, I think, and we really do want to draw a distinction here. We are used to public debate. In fact, we welcome it at the Productivity Commission. It's why we have interim reports. It's to draw comments and reflections on our work and criticism of our work. It makes our work stronger. And we are aiming, of course, to inform public policy debate, which can often get heated. Our view is that a line was crossed in terms of the nature of those comments from the Western Australian Premier last month. You didn't run those comments, but he also called the report deceitful.
And you communicated that to him, to his office?
We will be today meeting with the Western Australian Treasurer, who's coming to meet with us in Melbourne, and we will be conveying that message quite clearly. We welcome debate and we welcome criticism of our work and our report more broadly, because it makes our work stronger, and that's the process that we will be going through. But to undermine and, I guess, attack our integrity, I think, is an additional bridge too far, and I think something that more broadly we are seeing in public debate internationally, and, you know, we don't, you know, we want to call this out as being unacceptable.
So you say that the West Australian Premier's response has crossed the line. Have you communicated that to the federal government?
Look, I'm not going to go into sort of discussions that we have or not. I mean, the other things that obviously have occurred this week also include that we have felt the need to clarify is that the Prime Minister has made comments in Western Australia around, you know, the government's intent or otherwise with respect to the recommendations in the report. We would say that that's disappointing at this point in the process. And the main reason for that is, you know, we do now go out and consult on our interim recommendations. We'll take further evidence. We'll take submissions. That's a very important part of our process. We often refine our recommendations. We may well change our recommendations in some instances, depending on the feedback we receive. It's important for us to indicate that that process will not be influenced by the Prime Minister's comments, that we are above politics, and that's a very important position that we hold.
Economist Dr. Angela Jackson is a commissioner at the Productivity Commission, and she co-authored the GST Distribution Reforms Interim Report. Let's bring Tom Crowley back in for his analysis on what we just heard from Dr. Jackson.
Angela Jackson, who, like her co-author Alex Robson, saying, look, the Productivity Commission welcomes robust debate, have a go at us if you like, but that some of the personal insults, and I think particularly some umbrage taken at the suggestion that the staff and the researchers who worked on this report might be called clowns from the Western Australian Premier, I think that's the line that really rankles. The stuff about economic rationalists, you know, I mean, the Prime Minister's not the first person to have called the Productivity Commission boffins that, and he won't be the last, so maybe that doesn't matter quite so much, but it does get pretty colourful. That was the word Tim Ayres used, over in Western Australia on this issue, but whether that's colourful, whether you should stray into calling public servants that, that's what we're debating.
There's never enough Tom Crowley, right? Along with Luke hosting Radio National Breakfast this morning, Tom stepped in for a couple of major interviews, including with Tim Ayres, who he just mentioned there. The federal government is hoping to settle new energy and water rules for data centres at a national cabinet meeting later today, despite opposition from Queensland and the Northern Territory. The disagreement revolves around the requirement that data centres contribute to their own power in the form of renewables, with gas as a firming option. Tim Ayres is the Minister for Industry and Innovation and Minister for Science, and here's what Tom asked him first.
This National Cabinet meeting today, does the government need to get Queensland and the Northern Territory on board here, or will they be irrelevant if you're going to come over the top with federal legislation?
Well, federal legislation that the Prime Minister outlined in that speech just a month or so ago is absolutely crucial to ensuring that we don't have a race to the bottom on artificial intelligence standards and on data centres, on electricity, water, and all of those community benefits that we want to make sure the data centres land in the right places and that they serve the local and the community interest as well as the national interest. But it's also important that there be a collaborative approach, and I'm looking forward to seeing the outcome of the National Cabinet later on this morning.
So important to get a collaborative approach, but the government's view is that the federal legislation is ultimately what matters, and that today's meeting, you know, it would be good to get agreement, but not essential. Is that right?
Well, it's absolutely crucial that we don't have a race to the bottom in particular, electricity and water, but more broadly, the data standards that the data center standards that the Prime Minister set out. That's not in the national interest. This is a big challenge and a big opportunity for Australia. If we lean back and miss the opportunity, that has negative consequences for our economy, our productivity, and our security. If we lean in and get this right as one country with one approach rather than eight different approaches, then that offers the opportunity to make sure that artificial intelligence and data centres and AI training is harnessed here in the national interest in a coordinated and effective way that makes Australia stronger.
So given that, is the federal government open to changing any of the rules or any of the wording around renewable energy, for instance, to get those two jurisdictions on board, or is this a take-it-or-leave-it proposition?
Well, it's absolutely essential as we rebuild our and modernise our electricity system, that Australia doesn't go backwards in terms of our electricity system. Well, that is a system that is based on solar and wind, backed by gas and backed by storage. That is the electricity system that we need to build to lower costs and make Australia more competitive and more resilient. that we don't take a backward step here. It's exactly the same as the approach that we've taken in Queensland around the Boyne aluminium smelter, our second largest smelter, Queensland's largest user of electricity, industrial electricity. There's no difference between a big industrial electricity user and a data centre. That big industrial facility, joint intervention from Queensland and from the Australian government, will be powered by wind and solar, backed by batteries and gas, because that is the lowest cost, most efficient outcome, and it lowers costs for every Queensland household and every Queensland business.
Right, moving on to one other issue. The Productivity Commission seems to be a little upset by the insults directed their way over the last few days over their report on the WA GST deal, an interim report. Roger Cook called them clowns, and Madeleine King, your colleague, said that she could understand that language even if she wouldn't use it herself. The Prime Minister's dismissed their views as those of, quote, economic rationalists. Is it appropriate to attack public servants for their independent advice?
Oh, we're in a democracy, Tom, where there's strong views in Western Australia about this question, and people have expressed those views. The Productivity Commission has important work to do for Australia, and we're not a government that gets reports that contest our view and has a glass jaw about that. That was the previous government's approach.
But you talk about glass jaws. I mean, you know, for Roger Cook to call them clowns, is that a bit of a glass jaw?
Oh, it's a colourful expression. That's true. It's a colourful expression.
Tim Ayres is a Minister for Industry and Innovation and Minister for Science. Well, returning to the data centres conversation, one of the holdouts with the government's renewables plan is the Northern Territory. Its chief minister is Leah Fenocchiaro, and here's her interview with Tom Crowley.
Are you open to be persuaded by the Prime Minister in today's meeting, or have you made your mind up on these principles?
Well, we're standing really strong on the fact that the Territory should be able to decide its energy policy and its energy mix. We understand that the federal government are, you know, pursuing a renewable agenda, and there's no problem with that per se. But what they should not be doing is trying to impose rules on states and territories when they, under their own steam, are able to make these decisions for themselves, for their people.
As you say, you know, the federal government is trying to set up some nationally consistent rules here. Do you see a case for nationally consistent rules of some sort so that you don't have horses for courses, or you do think that states and territories should each go their own way?
No, I think states and territories are elected by their community to represent the views of their community and make the laws that suit those people. And ultimately, we don't need the federal government coming in heavy-handed and trying to dictate to states and territories how they should be developing data centres or not and what energy mix they should be using. In the Territory, we have an incredibly unique situation where in less than 7 days' time, the Beetaloo Basin will be powering Territory homes and businesses. And there is enough gas in that reservation to power our entire nation for 200 years, plus support our allies and the region. And so we're in a very unique and special situation, which we want recognised by the federal government.
So have you spoken to the Prime Minister or any federal counterparts in the lead up to this meeting about that, and what have they said to you?
Today is the first real chance to ventilate these issues. My colleagues have been at different ministerial levels. I know the treasurers and the energy ministers have been discussing these, but we're very clear in our position as a Northern Territory. We do not want to be dictated to by Canberra. I can tell you, Tom, there's nothing Territorians hate more than a heavy-handed federal government, and I'll be here to stand our ground and make sure that Territorians are put first at National Cabinet today.
Northern Territory Chief Minister Leah Fenocchiaro. Thank you for listening to all those interviews from Tom Crowley and Luke Sydham-Dundon. Today's podcast was produced by Oscar Coleman. I'm Katie McAllister, and more stories from us, same time, same place, tomorrow.